Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is science communicator, Dr. Kiki Sanford. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, it is nice to have you on the show. You are very well known for your work as a science communicator. And I ran across you, I think it was Jennifer Ouellette, who's a science writer. And I think she tweeted something that you did, and then I started reading about your work and your background in science communication. I said, this person has to be on Background Mode, because we've had so many cool writers and scientists on the show.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk with you. Thank you.
So you started off with your undergraduate work with a BS in conservation biology. What is that?
Yeah, so when I started my undergraduate studies, I kind of didn't really know what I was going to do, and I thought I was going to join Greenpeace and save the elephants. So I followed a conservation biology path of study, and the idea is that you find out about animals, their environment, ecology, and how humans impact the environment, how we all live on the earth together, and then try and figure out how we can conserve different species of animals so we don't run them down the road of extinction. Sometimes biologically, ecologically, humans play a part in it, and we can help. Other times, it's just a natural process, and part of it is understanding the difference.
How did you get on that bandwagon? What experience ignited your interest in conservation?
I grew up out in the country, kind of surrounded by nature. I mean, as much as agriculture can be considered natural.
Of course.
But I ran around, you know, but the fields. I mean, I really literally grew up in the middle of a bunch of fields. And so I spent my childhood swimming in ditches and running up and down the rows, playing with the animals that we had. And I raised chickens. I grew up really surrounded by life. And so it made a big impact on me as a person. And I was, I guess in high school, I was very optimistic and had this idea that I could really help to change things and save the world, you know, and then I got older and jaded, but.
Well, you know, there is this meme in our society that young women who show a strong interest in science or sometimes run into obstacles. Did you have a teacher or two or three who sort of took you under their wings and inspired you?
I think, you know, my parents definitely inspired me. They always pushed me to ask questions. My dad was always, if I had a point of view, he would debate it. He always wanted to debate. And so that was a big part of coming up with my viewpoint and knowing how to argue my points.
What did your dad do?
He's a contractor, but he did. He got a psychology degree. So he's an intellectual, and he pushed me in that direction for sure. And then I did have lots of role models. Specifically in college, I had many female role models. There were so many female professors in the wildlife biology department. There was one woman who taught a freshwater aquatic ecology class that she sent us out to do experiments, and then we'd come back and talk about jumping in puddles and what we saw or what we didn't see. And we talked a lot about animals. And then as I got into graduate school, there were even more female role models for me. And so all along
this
the way,
this was at UC Davis, right?
At UC Davis. Yeah. And I feel like, yes, there were a lot of male scientists who were really inspirational as well. They never told me I couldn't do it. I had a really lucky, wonderful path, I think. Along the way, female role models who I could aspire to be like, and also men who were, you know, who supported me as well. And so it was always very good. I didn't ever have anybody say, you can't do this, or try and hold me back for some reason.
Awesome. I remember myself, two very influential teachers. When I was in seventh grade, I had a science teacher, Mr. Williams, who was big into astronomy, and he got us outdoors and connected to a little 6-inch Edmond telescope.
Oh,
and
cool.
We started doing star parties, and I saw Saturn's rings for the first time, for real, through a real telescope, not a picture in a book. And I had also a seventh grade teacher, a math teacher, Mr. Gerritsen, who was probably the best teacher I've ever had in my whole life. And he just ignited us in our interest in mathematics. And between those two teachers, I was off and running as a young astrophysicist. It was amazing. Your story sounds a lot like the Richard Feynman story, the physicist, because he went for walks with his dad, and his dad would ask him questions, and they'd quiz about nature, and he'd tell young Richard, he said, just knowing the name of a bird doesn't tell you that you know anything about the bird except its name, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I have yet to really impact quantum physics, but I'm doing my best, you know, I'm doing my best to help educate people and inspire them.
I was watching Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson the other night, and he was talking about curiosity. If you're curious and you want to know things, there's no limit to what you can do.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's something that I hope I inspire in other people. I try to be curious and ask questions. I mean, one of my favorite things is going, hey, I don't know why that works. You know, I see somebody's tweet and it leads me to an article, and I start reading an article and I go, but wait, that doesn't really make sense. How does that work? And then I start digging down further and asking more questions and reading more about things until I hit the end of the line and I go, oh, people don't know any more than this. And that's a really cool thing to figure out.
It is. It's sort of like my life as a McIntosh writer, because something happens and you go, how does that work? And you start figuring it out, and then you end up writing about it. Yeah. So you have a PhD in molecular, cellular, and integrative physiology. What does that all mean? That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. And I mean, if you want to simplify what my PhD is actually in, it's in bird brains. So
frozen slices?
Frozen slices, but also living animals. I focused on the interface of brain and behavior, and looking at a specific area of the brain called the hippocampus, which birds have, mammals have, but they're in different parts of the brain. We've discovered over many years of research that the mammalian hippocampus and the avian hippocampus, they have the same function, and they potentially derive from the same embryonic tissue. They just move to different places, locations in the brain.
What does the hippocampus do?
The hippocampus, as I was just getting to, the hippocampus is important for memory consolidation. So learning and memory was what I was focused on. And so in birds, birds have little tiny brains, right? And they have amazing behaviors that they can successfully do with these little tiny brains, like storing food for the winter. In Siberia, there's a species of bird called the Siberian tit that stores, over the course of a couple of months, up to 250,000 little tiny pieces of food that help to sustain it.
Wow.
Through the winter and into the spring breeding months. Yeah. And it's just a little tiny chickadee-sized bird. It's just not a large bird. And I mean, I forget where my keys are. How do these birds remember?
There's an app for that. Find my keys.
Yeah. So there are these great feats of memory. And the Siberian tit is not the only bird that does this. Corvids, like the scrub jay, magpies, many other species of birds store food and survive off those food stores. How do they learn and remember all those different locations? What are their strategies? And how does the brain, how do the neurons within the hippocampus work to allow that to happen? Same question is for migration. How do birds wake up one morning as a young bird and say, I'm going to fly south for the winter?
I got to ask you about that. Of course, you opened the door now. Do we really have a good understanding of how birds navigate in their migrations? Is it genetic, or is it magnetic, or what?
And it's a combination of many different things. And it's thought that there's definitely an instinctual component to, okay, I have to go south, but where do they go? How do they know exactly which breeding ground or which wintering ground
is? Is it like pattern recognition?
And so there is a portion of pattern recognition, and that's, so it's like, it has to do with large scale navigation and more localized pattern recognition and landmark recognition.
Yeah.
And so there are star compasses, there's magnetic reception navigation, and there's a certain amount of instinct involved in, okay, I'm going to get up, I'm going to fatten myself up, I'm going to fly with the other birds, and then I'll land where they're landing. And so there is definitely the genetic instinctual component, but the large scale navigation is like magnetic and
yes.
the star compass. So that when birds navigate at night, they learn to use the positions of the stars as part of their navigating compass.
When it's cloudy, I guess they fall back on the magnetic part. I read one time,
yeah,
I think it was Scientific
help.
American,
yeah.
that birds are found to have like little ferromagnetic particles in their brains.
This is something that is still not very known. We don't really understand exactly what is going on with the magnetic reception. You know, so like in our noses, we know we have olfactory receptors that grab onto scent molecules and allow us to transmit this scent, this whatever this scent is, to our brain that our brain can recognize. But where are the magnetic receptors? What is moving around and changing in the brain? And so these little iron particles, basically, in the brain might be part of it. It's also not necessarily the brain. It's thought that it's in the back of the eyes, so in the optic receptors. There are a bunch of different ideas, but this is not yet completely understood. We know that they can do it. And you can mess up a bird's navigation if you were to put them under a big magnetic field, you can make them go a different direction.
Wow, yeah, you got me all excited. Now you've got me wanting to dissect birds. I'm so excited.
Yeah, there's so many interesting questions.
You know,
yeah, how do the cells work? How do the neurons work? How do they interact with the outside world to change the bird's behavior, to allow it to do certain things? Or how does that behavior, conversely, also... can it change the brain?
Have we mapped the genome of the larger birds?
That's a really good question. I don't think we've done a lot of
done mice, but
yeah,
I don't know if we've done birds.
I honestly, maybe like a chicken or something, or a pigeon maybe, but
yeah.
I honestly, that's a great question. That's something I'll have to go look up after we're done talking.
Well, you listeners, we are challenging you now to go out and figure out all these things. Cool.
Yeah.
So was the research work you were doing after you got your doctorate then?
Yeah, that was for my doctorate. And then after my doctorate, it was during my PhD years that I realized that even though I was interested in these scientific questions, my favorite moments were when I was explaining science to people. So it was teaching a class or going to a conference and talking with people about what we'd done and throwing different ideas about what could be going on around with them. And then also I had started during graduate schools when I started This Week in Science, which is my podcast, but I started it as a radio show at KDVS, the UC Davis's campus radio station. And so doing my show was also one of my favorite things to do. And I moved on. I had some great support in moving out of academia and going into science communications. And that is the path that I have taken.
I'm going to take you on a detour here for a second.
Yeah.
Yes. Intra-subroutine. My wife and I both studied Kenpo karate, and I have a, I have a blue belt in Kenpo, and had to abandon my studies when I moved, but that was years ago. And I've talked to several guests who pursued belt in karate, and you have a black belt in taekwondo. Amidst all this science research and the things that you were doing, How did you have time for that? And what turned you on to that?
So within my graduate career, I took a little break for a little while. I had a little hiccup in, after I was done with the first couple of years of my studies. The professor I was working with in her lab, she was originally from the UK, and she decided that she was going to move back to the UK. She accepted a job at Cambridge University. And so she said, I'm not taking the lab with me. If you can come up with the money, you can come. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to come up with the money to move myself to Cambridge. And at the same time, I'd also just met my husband-to-be, and so I was romantically involved. And I was like, I don't really want to move to England right now.
Was he a karate student too?
He is not, but he was in San Francisco. And so I moved to San Francisco for a little while, which is another great little tangent to my life. I ended up working in a neuropsychopharmacology lab doing human studies on addictive drugs, which was a weird little phase of my research career. Loved it. But at the same time, I needed something to do, and there was a karate studio near my house in my apartment in San Francisco, and so I started going there, and several nights a week, I would make my way to my karate studio, and that studio was teaching Kyokushin karate, and so I got a blue belt in Kyokushin karate, and then at the same time, I was working and then in the lab, but at the same time, I was trying to figure out how I was going to complete my PhD. And so I was talking with researchers, other people at UC Davis about figuring it out. And I did figure it out eventually, got some wonderful people to accept me into their lab to finish my studies. And then I moved back to Davis and I was like, I cannot give up the martial arts. This is like keeping me sane. This is giving me this physical outlet that I definitely needed, and it to focus myself. And it's also, you know, there's something almost a meditative quality about some of the forms and the practices.
Oh yes. And the development of the body is the path to development of the mind as well.
Yeah.
I found karate to be a great complement to skiing. It just seems to have all the mental and physical aspects to complement skiing. Because in skiing, you have to do scary things. You have to lean downhill instead of uphill. You have to be physically fit. You have to have situational awareness. They're a perfect match for each other. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you're doing horse stance all the time, you're definitely strengthening your legs enough to go down that hill. Yeah. But I ended up finding a studio that I really liked, that was Taekwondo in Davis when I went back to UC Davis to finish my PhD. And that's where I got my black belt.
Cool. Great story. Hey, I think it's a perfect time for a break right now. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the work you're doing now in This Week in Science, and some geek talk about Apple and artificial intelligence and some other cool stuff. So, listeners, we'll be right back after this break. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm talking with Dr. Keke Sanford. Dr. Sanford, tell me about your early work in communication. What were your initial projects, and how did that inform you about how to proceed and expand your work?
So I think, you know, This Week in Science was definitely my first foray into the informal science communication world, which, you know, is communicating science outside of an educational platform. And so that was a good start for me to learn how to find my voice, how to speak on the radio into a microphone, how to talk about science to a general audience. But I really got a leg up on how to tell a story when I got a fellowship. I applied for what's called the AAAS Mass Media and Technology, I think it's Mass Media and Engineering Fellowship is what it was. And through this fellowship, through the American Association for the Advancement of Science, I was embedded into a media outlet, which was WNBC, the local NBC affiliate in New York City, for 10 weeks. And I went and I worked with medical and health reporter Max Gomez in New York City. I went to Rockefeller Center every day while I was working there, living there, and learned how to write the news. And it was just, it was like an in-depth go for it every day, going out on video shoots, learning what was important visually, learning what was important to get for audio, and then learning how to cut everything together and put it into a story that could be shown in the 5 o'clock news.
That's a lot of technology. People, yeah. I don't think, appreciate the technical tools and integrative technology that it takes to, you know, produce, put together an interview or an on-site visit and get that produced into an enticing and interesting and entertaining and educational video. That's tough.
Yeah,
it is. I'm in awe.
So it was a really wonderful experience. I'm so lucky to have been accepted for that program and to have gotten to do the fellowship that I got to do. And then after that, Dr. Gomez's producer quit and he needed an interim producer. And so I was asked to stay on for a couple of months while they hired somebody else. And so I actually got to do a few more months where I was actually the producer for the reporter for the 5 o'clock news medical and health segment.
This is a thread I'm seeing with a lot of the guests. This led to that, and then I did this, and then I got to know that person, and then this happened, and then this door opened, and then I did this. This is a recurring theme here.
Yeah, and so This Week in Science, we started putting on, I was still doing This Week in Science during this whole time on the radio. We put it on the internet. We made it a podcast. We started our RSS feed sometime in like 2003, I think. And then let's see, iTunes got its start in 2005, and we were one of the first podcasts in the science section in iTunes. And then I went to a podcasting conference. And so 2005 was a big year because that was my AAAS fellowship year also. But then I went to this podcasting conference and I met this guy named Alex Lindsay, who was working with Twit. And I was like, I looked at his name tag and I was like, This Week in Tech, I'm This Week in Science. We should talk. And he said, yeah, we should talk. And we started talking about stuff. And he's like, oh, you do science. Okay. We'll get back and let's do a project together. Let's work on stuff. And we threw some ideas back and forth. And this was kind of in the beginning of the online video for iTunes, really high quality video. And we put together a video cast called Food Science. And so it was, somebody took it offline recently and I don't know why, and I got to get it back online because I think it's a wonderful educational, asset for teachers who are trying to teach chemistry and biology concepts. But we did Food Science together, and that was really, I did that and I was like, I love doing online video. I really love explaining, and I wrote all the scripts. I did the producing for it, came up with the visual concepts for the animations in the videos. Like, it was really hands-on for me, and I just went, it blew my mind, and I loved it.
You are the modern Mr. Wizard.
Yeah, I got to be for a little while, at least.
I grew up watching Mr. Wizard. That was another inspiration for me. Yeah. Yeah, he's probably before your time.
No, I know Don Mr. Herbert. Wizard. Yeah.
He was so cool.
Yeah. And so I did food science. And then from that, I met Leo Laporte and I met Scott Edelson and I met who else? I've met a whole bunch of people. I got introduced to Revision 3 and then worked with them on a project called Pop Siren, which was a female hosted technology and science variety show. And I got to do very much Mr. Wizard type demonstrations on that program.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I want to jump.
And then more.
Well, yeah, there's a lot there, and I think the listeners are probably getting a really good feel for what the scope of what you've been doing, but we don't have a whole lot of time left, and I wanted to take the last few minutes of the show to talk to you about some of the things you've been doing recently. I watched, not all of it, but the beginning of a video podcast you did where you were involved in neurogaming.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I was intrigued by that because we tend to think of VR and gaming as being a visual effect, but there's more to it than that.
Absolutely. I mean, everything we do with gaming, it's like any kind of tool. You've got a pencil. It's an extension of your body. It's this tool that you can use to interact with the world. But when you're gaming, your world is now inside this virtual framework. And you don't necessarily need to have a gaming handset or even a glove to do your gaming. Now we have these headsets, right?
Are the headsets able to impact your neurology?
Yes and no. So they're getting better. The idea is that they pick up electrical activity in your brain. They have little sensors. Basically, it's like a very simplified EEG receiver, and there are usually two, three, four sensors that sit on your head in various
locations.
But it's
one way, right? It's just a passive receptor picking up. It's not trying to influence the brain in turn.
Well, it's not. It's not electrically stimulating your head to stimulate your brain cells. It's not magnetically stimulating your head to stimulate and to induce a current in your brain cells. It's not doing anything like that. There's no direct stimulation of the brain. But where the neurogaming does affect your brain is, like I mentioned earlier, through behavior. And so if you've ever heard of neurofeedback, the way a lot of these games work is that you have to focus on the task at hand. And if you get distracted, your brain signals go all over the place and the sensors are not really able to pick up a clear signal to control the video game that you're playing. And so in order to play, whether it's a gamified meditation game or whether it's, I played one game that was battling wizards and it was kind of like this fantasy based magic game, but I had to sit there and really calm my head to focus on one particular aspect of the game. And so in terms of neurofeedback, it's like meditation in that you are controlling the activity of your brain cells.
This is cool.
Cool. Yeah. So you're changing the overall frequency of firing of your brain cells.
So it's sort of yoga 3.0.
Yeah, exactly. And so, these neurogaming sets are going to get more and more sophisticated and probably better at picking up the activity in your brain. But it's between VR and the brain itself. I mean, our brain is what we use to basically make up the whole world around us, right? Let us know where we are, but our brain creates it for us. And so in VR, your brain is just going to create it for you, but you have to have a way for your brain to talk back and feedback. And this neurogaming can be a very positive force.
Do you think there's any opportunities? Now, I'm just winging it here. The more you talk, the more you inspire me to just, you know, drift off into subroutines. do you think there's a opportunity to use these gaming systems for educational purposes, the development of skills? We talked about karate a while back and visualization and kinesthetics. It seems to be there's a linkage there, or it might be a linkage, sort of, you know, VR feedback of focusing on your downhill run during your skiing or something like that.
Absolutely. I mean, there's definitely, I think there's a lot of promise for at least looking into it and seeing if it can have positive influence. We know there's evidence showing that meditation itself, or just mindfulness exercises, has a very positive impact on the behavior of children in schools. And if this is like mindfulness training, if there is some neurofeedback, focusing energy that can help kids focus and be more thoughtful and mindful every day, it definitely will have positive effects down the road. So there's definitely room there.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I'll start paying attention to that more and more. Yeah. What I've been paying attention to lately is artificial intelligence. I've been writing a lot about that. You know, there's a lot of interest in AI agents. We're very familiar with Cortana and the Echo system, Alexa, mm-hmm. and Apple Siri. And there seems to be this emerging awareness that artificial intelligence agents are going to take a larger and larger role. And as soon as we start thinking about AI agents in our lives, we start getting into some scary factors. I was talking to Dr. David Brin, the sci-fi writer, recently about classes. It was my idea of classes of artificial intelligence agents, trying to rank them, you know, from class one down at Siri to, you know, class five Skynet or something like that.
Right.
And in the middle is Watson and the HAL 9000 and all these artificial intelligence agents that we see and hear about in science fiction and technical writing. And it seems to me like it's going to become quickly very scary as we start interacting with these AI agents in terms of being exposed to their intellects, perhaps being used by companies in our behalf, but sometimes maybe on their behalf. It starts to get into some very interesting ethical issues. Have you been following the ethics of AI agents?
Yeah, I think it's something that people should be very concerned about. I mean, we've given our lives over to social media platforms like Facebook, Google Plus, Twitter, you know, Snapchat, you name it. We're just giving them our personal information. And in a sense, you know, we get a lot back from these platforms, but it's companies who have a financial economic bottom line, who don't necessarily have our best interests at heart because of having to get some, you know,
I know
they want to get their investors the top dollar back, right?
I tell the story about Siri coming to me one day in 2019 and says, "I bought your new car." And I said, "I didn't authorize that." And Siri says, "Well, I was fighting this class five AI agent who called me, and I couldn't help myself. I was helpless. I couldn't do anything. He talked me into buying you a car. So here it is."
Yeah. And as it is, we've got, you know, ads being served to us based on our online behavior. There's a lot of stuff that's already automatic, you know, and there's this, like you said, maybe this low level artificial intelligence serving us ads that, oh, you might be more likely to buy that. But then maybe there's the next step, which is Siri actually buying it for you without you saying you want it. And
it's scary stuff.
It is scary stuff. I don't think that we need to be terrified at this point because there's a lot of it that's going to be very helpful. But I think it's very important that any companies that will be implementing any kind of AI be held to a very high standard of use, and that there should be some kind of international agreement on, you know, that's come to, you know, not by governments necessarily, but by companies, by people like Elon Musk and others who are working on this stuff, to actually consider what can we do with AI, how far can we go with it, what are the programming basics that need to be implemented to make sure that an accidental AI intelligence increase doesn't lead to, you know, everybody becoming gray goo just because somebody, you know, attached, you know, somebody connected their experimental AI to the internet and suddenly we're all dead. We don't want that. We don't want that to happen. There need to be certain rules in place. And I hope that the people who are experimenting and building the AIs are really trying to come up with good rules.
I saw one researcher talking the other day about how that isn't going to happen for another 30 or 50 years. And I thought, you know, that's just failing to take responsibility for the exponential increase of what's going to happen and pushing the problem off on somebody else. It's got to be dealt with now.
It does need to be dealt with now because people are advancing the technology now. I mean, there are people in academic labs, you know, engineers, computer scientists, neuroscientists who are working together to create stuff in an academic setting. Then there are also people who are programming in their garages or in their, you know, back bedroom, their office.
And we're going to have autonomous cars that are making ethical decisions about should I run over the pedestrian or save the lives of the passengers and all sorts of ethical issues there.
Yeah, there's a lot developing very quickly. And if we do not take it seriously now, it'll be too late later.
Have you done any shows on that? Are you going to?
I've spoken with very interesting people. For instance, Philip Rosestone, I did an interview with him for Nautilus Mag. And he was talking about his work with Second Life, Philip Rosedale, and his work with Second Life, and now, what's the name of his new business venture? It's a virtual reality avatar business. Why am I forgetting it?
Do you know Dr. David Brin, the physicist, science fiction writer? He's into that a lot. I think he's speaking at a conference this week or next on artificial intelligence ethics or something like that, he told me.
Yeah, David Brin is wonderful. I've followed his work. I've been a fan of his writing for years. And on Google Plus, it's just been wonderful to be able... He writes at length on his posts on Google Plus, and it's always nice to be able to see what he's writing and thinking. And he's just on the... He's a thinker, which we need more of these people. Yeah. Okay. High Fidelity. That's Philip Rosedale's company. But he's also, there are a lot of people who are very, who follow, say, Ray Kurzweil's ideas very closely. But I think there need to be people who are not always so positive about it. We need the naysayers also in on the conversation.
Yeah, I think Stephen Hawking is one of those who's expressed some alarm about what could happen. Well, you know, we're about out of time. We've been talking a wide range of topics. It's really inspiring. We started off with ecology, and then we went into migration of birds, and I never got a chance to ask you about your iPhone that you don't have. We'll have to do that another time. We got off onto some really fun and exciting stuff. I know you've got me. Just talking to you makes me excited. And I'm a retired physicist myself. And you've got me even more excited. So,
oh, good. Yay.
I can see how effective you are as a science communicator.
Thank you.
So we're going to have to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. And this is going to be really exciting for our listeners. Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Yeah, so if people are interested, you can go to about.me/Dr. Kiki if you want to find out more about me. And I have my Twitter account is @DrKiki, DrKiki. And This Week in Science you can find at twis.org. We're also on YouTube. You can find it if you go to twis.org/YouTube.
Cool. We'll put all that in the show notes.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you again for being on the show. And all you listeners out there, I hope you're really turned on now and want to become scientists. This is great. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.